that I listen to and really get something out of. I am of the mindset to share it with the people that I love, with my community, with our shul, with the entire state of Arizona. So it was interesting. A few months ago, I sent out an email to my sisters and their families. Does anyone have an idea for a speaker this year? So I heard from a few. I heard from my son. You know, there's a rabbi who came to Los Angeles as a scholar in residence to the Young Israel of Century City. He was very good. You might like him. My sister and brother-in-law from Stamford, Connecticut, Sharon and Michael Feldstein, said there was a rabbi who came to Stamford, Connecticut for the Chevra Kedisha dinner, and he was very good. You might like him. My sister Lee, who lives in Lawrence in Long Island, says, I go to a shir every Tuesday morning, and the Magid shir there is wonderful. He has many people come every Tuesday morning. It's a shir for women. My sister told me a secret. Please don't repeat this anywhere. But some men actually sneak into the shir, sit behind the mechitza just to grasp at the Torah of our speaker this evening. The stories were different from the family members who responded, but the person was the same, and they all said Rabbi Shai Schachter. So I tuned into yutorah.org. That's yutorah.org. Under Rabbi Shai Schachter, he gives quite a few shiurim, and while I was pedaling my pounds away on my bicycle, I listened to shiurim by Rabbi Schachter. And I said, my sisters and my son made a fabulous choice, and we called and we invited Rabbi Schachter to join us this evening. So without further ado, and on behalf of my father, Reb Zalman Siegel Shlita, my sister Debbie and Harris Cooperman, my sister Lee and Steve Weinstein, my sister Sharon and Michael Feldstein, my sister Rena and Bumi Pinter, and myself, and of course, last but not least, my Ashes Chayil, who's returning this year in person to be with us. She's well, thank God, and we're grateful for that. And she affords me the luxury of spending time being Isaac in these things for the community. And without further ado, please give a warm Phoenix welcome to Rabbi Shai Schachter.
That really is a very warm Phoenix welcome. I can tell you, we certainly don't do that out in our neighborhood, and I have something to bring home now. Something I can teach the members of our community, I guess. So thank you to the entire Siegel family for your persistence in making sure that I would be here this evening. And I'm honored to be a part of this celebration of life, of your mother's life, the beautiful legacy that she lives over. And I have to say, I always feel lonely traveling by myself, so I made sure to bring your siblings from the East Coast so that I would feel at home. So thank you. Thank you for coming. And it's great to see so many old friends who are here, so many of the Rabbanim who I learned with in Yeshiva, who I haven't seen in so many years. It's very, very special to be out here. I can only hope that you continue. And my lookalike, who just moved to the neighborhood, you should give a warm Phoenix welcome to Rabbi Daniel Natel, who just moved out here. And he is very often confused with me, or I should say I am confused with him. He's the more famous one, as you will get to know. So it's really a great pleasure to be out here. And especially during the month of Elul, as we ready ourselves for Rosh Hashanah and for Yom HaKippur, Maaseres Yemei Teshuva, there's so much to talk about, but something that I always find very uncomfortable at this time of year is how do we have the gall to get up and speak about what the answer is to the process of tshuva. The way I see Rosh Hashanah, perhaps there are others who identify with this feeling, it's a difficult, a overwhelming time of year. And who is a person who dare say that they know the answer to how to experience this properly? So the Dubna Magid gave me a lot of comfort because I once read an insight of the Dubna Magid, and he said that it comes to this time of year and he feels, I am so inadequate. How can I say anything? How am I the person who's going to give the answer to my community? And the Dubna Magid said that it reminded him, Mashal Anachei Raglaim, he says there was a man who was crippled. And this man always had somebody who had to help him out. One evening he's sleeping And 3 o'clock in the morning, he looks out the window and he sees down the block that there is a raging fire. And he notices that that fire is very quickly spreading. The house is burning down, but it's spreading to the house next door as well. And he says he didn't know what to do because over the course of a couple of minutes, it would ultimately spread to his home, and he had no way of saving himself. He was a cripple, and he was so concerned. So he takes out a trumpet, and he starts blowing out his window as loud as he can, and he's hoping that somebody's going to hear. And his neighbors wake up, and they turn to him, and they say, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Look at that fire. Look what's happening." And he says, "Perhaps if I blow it loud enough, if I make enough noise, maybe somebody else will wake up and save themselves, and in the course, in the process of them saving themselves, they will save me along with them as well." So the Dubna Maggid said, "Am I a person who has the answers? Absolutely not. But perhaps," he said, "if I make enough noise, if one person will be inspired as we have a conversation together, as we think about and consider what the tshuva process is meant to be all about," he said, "maybe while somebody in the audience is trying to save themselves, maybe they'll save me as well." So maybe there's a sincere Jew out here in Phoenix who is working hard to try and save themselves. And I ask you, be kind enough to save some of us along with you as well. Nobody has the answer. Nobody is prepared adequately enough to really know how we're supposed to make it through this time of year. But maybe if there's a very sincere person who understands how they're supposed to live through this time of year, how they're supposed to experience it, take along your friends, somebody else who you will be able to inspire, and perhaps that will be the ticket to all of our bakashas, to all of our requests, to all that we ask for in this time of year. So there's a beautiful story told about the great Baal Shem Tov, and I find that often the stories that were told back then happened in Russia. So the Baal Shem Tov lived in Russia, and one day he's looking out his window and he sees Chaikel, the local water carrier, slowly pedaling through the streets, and he's carrying his weighty buckets hanging over his shoulders. And the Baal Shem Tov notices this man hunched over, and he feels so bad, and he calls out, he says, "Rab Chaikel, how's Parnassa? How's business today?" So he says, "You really want to know? I'll tell you, my life is awful. My life is terrible. I don't wish my kind of life upon anybody. After all," he says, "I'm an old man. Most people my age don't have to work this hard. I get up every morning, early in the morning. I go out to work, and I don't just do office work. I walk around the town with heavy buckets of water. It's a very difficult job that I have." And he says, "It's so hard for me. By the time I get to the homes of my customers, most of the water has already spilled out of the buckets. I don't really know why I do this job, because the truth is, when I come home at nights, my whole family laughs at me. I don't generate enough income to support my family. We don't even have enough food to eat. So I really don't know why I do this. My life is horrible. My life is very difficult." And the Baal Shem Tov, not really knowing what to say, turns to this Rab Chaikel, to the water carrier, and he says, "You know, I hope that you have a lot of success. I hope that God gives you the strength to be happy and to find comfort in that which you do." The next day he notices again, Rab Chaikel is doing his job, he's carrying the water, and he sees as he's passing by his window, he calls out to him again, he says, "Rab Chaikel, the water carrier, how's Parnassa today? How's your business?" And he says, "You wouldn't believe it. I'm an old man. Most people my age have no drive to even wake up in the morning. They don't do anything. They stay in their homes. They have no interest in getting up. They have no place to go. They have nothing to do. They don't have any strength. And look at me. I'm an elderly gentleman, and still God has given me the strength to do a job. And not just to do a job, I'm carrying water through the town. And I'm still doing it successfully. And the people in our town are so kind to me. Because it's amazing. By the time I get to their homes, most of the water already has spilled out of the buckets, and yet they continue to hire me. It amazes me every day. The kindness of our community. How nice they are, how they're willing to hire me over and over again when they know I really don't do such a great job. And you know, when I come home at night, I get so much love from my wife and my children. I'm living a very blessed life. How can I complain?" So the Baal Shem Tov was puzzled. "Is this the same Rab Chaikel, the water carrier, that I spoke to yesterday? Is this the same man that I engaged in conversation who was so bitter about his life? And he said it wasn't until he met this man and he had these two very different reactions that he finally understood a very troubling Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah. So we're all familiar, Rosh Hashanah, we refer to it colloquially as the Yom HaDin. Rosh Hashanah is the day which is our personal, individual, and communal day of judgment. Where that comes from is a good question. If you look in the pages of Chumash, you won't find any mention, any trace of the awesomeness of the day of Rosh Hashanah. Doesn't say anywhere that this is the Yom HaDin, but tradition has it, and this is clearly spelled out in all of our tefillahs, in all of our davening, in all of our prayers that we say, that Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment. Kol bo'i olam yavrun lefanecha kivnei maron, the Gemara tells us. We assume that every human being passes before God in judgment. Kivnei maron, like sheep. The Gemara has a number of interpretations, but something big is happening on Rosh Hashanah. And we all know that Rosh Hashanah is something that makes us nervous. And yet at the same time, the Gemara also has an opinion which might be surprising to many of us, and the Baal Shem Tov found it very troubling. The Gemara says, Adam nidon b'chol yom. Man seems to be judged or reevaluated every day of the year. So which one is it? Are we judged on Rosh Hashanah? Is everything predetermined? Whatever is going to happen in the coming year, does that all have to be decided on Rosh Hashanah? Or do we assume that it's like a lingering process? And Adam nidon b'chol yom, every day we are reevaluated, and God gives us another opportunity to decide whether or not we are worthy, or whether or not perhaps life should change. You know, I think every year before Rosh Hashanah, and perhaps it's a good exercise, think how much has changed from last year at this time to this year at this time. So we just had in our community a horrible tragedy on Thursday. And unfortunately, it's just the one that's most fresh on my mind, but there are so many, unfortunately, that we can all think of. So much suffering. So much tragedy. We had a 41-year-old man who was completely healthy. He went on a business trip. He was sitting at dinner with his partners. He told them he wasn't feeling well. He went back to his hotel room. They didn't hear from him. They knocked down the door and they found him dead in his room. Horrible story. His oldest child is 13 years old. All of that was determined last Rosh Hashanah. Are we not concerned that Rosh Hashanah is the Yom HaDin? It's a day which should put fear into all of us. I had the privilege the last couple of summers, I serve as the rabbi in Camp Simcha. If you don't know what Camp Simcha is, you should be blessed never to have to know what it is. It is a camp that is for children who suffer with cancer. It's an exhilarating place to be, but a very painful place to be as well. So this summer, a young girl, 4 years old, who's had cancer for 2.5 years, lung cancer. Who ever heard of a 2.5-year-old who has lung cancer? And she came to camp, and 2 days after she got home, she passed away. Was that already determined last Rosh Hashanah? What a painful reality. How are we supposed to understand how it is that God can do such a thing? How it is that people suffer so seriously throughout the experience of life? It's difficult to think about it, but we all assume that that has already been decided on Rosh Hashanah. And yet the Gemara has a position, like we mentioned, that it seems to be not everything is determined on Rosh Hashanah. Adam nidon b'chol yom. Man continues to be reevaluated every day of the year. So which one is it? Explains the Baal Shem Tov, it's very simple. On Rosh Hashanah, it is determined which category of life we are going to live. Are we going to be mothers? Are we going to be fathers? Are we going to be brothers? Will we be sisters? Will I be a spouse? Will I be a husband? Will I be a wife? Will I be a child? All of that is determined on Rosh Hashanah, the category of life. Will I be a doctor or a lawyer, an educator, whatever it is that might be the category of life, that is all determined on Rosh Hashanah. However, The Baal Shem Tov said that once God has decided to give you that experience of life, to give you that extra moment, that extra day of life, Adam Nida Mechol Yom means I, as an individual, am given the opportunity, a renewed opportunity every day to decide how I'm going to spend that life that God has given me. Am I going to be acrimonious and bitter? Am I going to feel sorry for myself every day of life that I experience? Or will I be someone that has satisfaction in the life that I live? That is a decision that a human being is able to make for themselves every day. That is not determined on Rosh Hashanah. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God gives over to each of us, and He decides only the category of life, whether or not there will be life, but we have the opportunity to decide how we will spend that gift of life. What will we do with those precious moments and experiences that God blesses us with that so many others unfortunately do not have? When we come together to celebrate a full life that was lived, when we come together for a yard site to appreciate the life that was lived and that was experienced, it's an opportunity for us to think how lucky and how blessed we are to be given life. It's an opportunity to think about how much we need life, about how much we can accomplish in a life that we are given. And at the same time, God asks us to think about how we will spend those days of our life. What will we do? Adam nida mechol yom, man is given the renewed opportunity every day to decide how they are going to spend it. So about a year ago, I saw an amazing article. I will confess, I read many articles. This is not a political comment. I saw this one on CNN. I know some people like CNN, some people don't. But the article was fascinating to me. And it made me think very deeply about how much it applies to our religious experience as Jews. So, the topic that they're discussing, they refer to it as the illusion of control. Why the world is full of buttons that do not work. I'm just going to read a few excerpts from this article. And to me, I identified with it because I felt in some way it was really a description of myself. So it begins as follows. Have you ever pressed the pedestrian button at a crosswalk and wondered if it actually worked? So I will tell you, I live in Woodmere. It's a part of Long Island in New York. I live on the corner of Peninsula Boulevard and Forest Avenue. We have a light there. You've visited my block. We have a light right at the corner of my house. That does not change. So we are very lucky that on Shabbos, the municipality has figured out that there's something called a Shabbos clock. So it changes every 2 minutes or so. So on Shabbos, we're able to cross. It's a very busy street. On Yom Tov, we're stuck because for some reason, they haven't figured out that the same way they put a system in for Shabbos, we should also have it for the holidays, because we cannot press that button. So there could be situations where I'll stand with my children on the corner. I want to be a responsible adult. I don't want to jaywalk. So I'll stand on the corner with my children, Rosh Hashanah morning, 25 minutes. 25 minutes, I'll wait for that light to change. It will not change until another car maybe comes the other way and the light is then triggered. Often when I stand there during the week, I press the button, and guess what? Nothing happens. So I identified with this article immediately when I saw it because it was a description of myself. Not only that, they then discuss the closed door button in an elevator, while suspecting that it may, in fact, have no effect whatsoever. So 2 weeks ago, I was at a wedding, and there was a Jew from the West Coast, from Los Angeles, who had come in for this wedding. He sat down next to me. He says, "Are you Shai Schechter?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Do you live in Woodmere?" I said, "Guilty as charged, I do." So he says, "There's a big difference between the human beings who live on the East Coast and those who live on the West Coast." I said, "I could think of many differences." He says, "Well, if I had to boil it down to one thing, I would say, when we walk into an elevator, we believe be'emuna shalema that the doors are going to close. And you, for some reason, believe that without you pressing 100 buttons in the elevator, nothing will happen." I said, "It's an interesting way to categorize all human beings on the East Coast, but I do happen to be one of those people. I walk into an elevator, immediately I press the floor that I want to go to, and I not only press that floor, I start pressing the closed door button, and guess what happens? Nothing. So, listen to this. You are not alone, and you might be right, because the world is full of buttons that actually do nothing. They're sometimes called placebo buttons. Buttons that are mechanically sound that can be pushed, but they provide no functionality at all. This is according to Ellen Langer, a Harvard psychologist. They do have a psychological effect because taking some action leads people to feel a sense of control over a situation. And that feels good rather than being passive and just serving as a bystander. Doing something typically feels better than doing nothing. In New York City, only about 100 out of 1,000 crosswalk buttons actually function. This was confirmed by a spokesperson from the city's Department of Transportation in an email. I'll skip a little more. What about the most jab button of them all, the closed door button in an elevator? Well, if you live in the United States, it almost certainly does not work. And legally, it cannot work. Because in 1990, there was a bill in Congress that was passed that's called the American with Disability Act. And there was a concern that if somebody has some kind of disability that makes them take a little bit longer to get into the elevator, there was a concern that as they're trying to get in, the door is going to close on them. So there is a minimum amount of time that the doors need to remain open, legally. And you can press the button as many times as you want, and nothing will happen. This is what they refer to as placebo buttons. And when I thought about this article, it made me wonder, how much of our Judaism is also just placebo buttons? Things that don't actually make a difference to the lives that we live, to the experience that we have, to our relationship with God, but it just makes us feel good. Doing something typically feels better than doing nothing. So this time of year, we always have all kinds of people who advertise in our neighborhood. I'm sure the emails make it to this side of the world as well, but we always get emails. You want to have a great merit to make it through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in the proper way, we, for a small fee, will send somebody to daven 40 days in a row by Kevah Rachel for you, or by the Western Wall, or we will send somebody to bake challah on your behalf, or we will send you a necklace to wear for the next 40 days, or we will get together and all bake challah, or we will have a red string that we will send you in the mail. All kinds of wonderful ideas, and maybe they work, maybe they don't. I don't know. What I do know is that many of those activities have absolutely no impact on the lives that we live. They don't bring us closer to God. They don't deepen our relationship with Him at all. It's what I refer to as a placebo button. Makes us feel good. I'm doing something. But I haven't gotten myself any more of an understanding as to what this religion is all about and what God is all about and how He fits into the puzzle of my life. So inevitably, during this time of year, it is often quoted, the story that the Gemara records in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Zayin. So we're told about Elazar ben Derdaya. He was a Jew who lived an entire life of decadence and immorality, and there was nothing positive about his life. The mistakes that he made, we cannot even speak about in a Beis HaKnesses, in a shul. It's so inappropriate. And the Gemara says that he went to all corners of the globe to try and satiate his desire, to try to excite himself and take all the pleasures that he possibly could get out of his experience of life. The Gemara then says that at the last moment, he suddenly noticed that his life was so far off track, and he says, you know, maybe it's a good idea for me to consider becoming a Baal Tshuva. Maybe I should have some kind of serious thought about where my life is and how I can change it. And the Gemara says he breaks down crying, and he has a sincere, overwhelming experience of tshuva. And he has such deep remorse and regret, and he feels terrible about the life that he lived and the unbecoming lifestyle that he was experiencing. And the Gemara writes, after all that, he had such a passionate experience of tshuva, such an intense emotional ride, that he was considering every decision of his life, that Elazar ben Derdiah, this Jew, passed away because of what he went through. On that occasion, writes the Gemara, Yatsasa Baskal V'yamar, a heavenly voice came out and declared, Rebbe Elazar ben Derdiah, mezuman l'chayei ha'olam haba. Rebbe Elazar ben Derdiah, this great man, has a portion in the world to come. And upon hearing that, the Gemara comments, Bacha Rebbe V'yamar, the great Rebbe, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, our great teacher, began to cry when he heard that. And he commented, Yesh kona olama b'sha'a achas. There are people who have the opportunity to acquire a place, to procure a space in the world to come, in just a sha'a achas, in one moment, in a fleeting, ephemeral moment of tshuva. That's enough for them. So it's a beautiful story, a powerful story. But the Mizricha Magid wonders, why was Rebbe crying? Why would you cry if you saw such a thing unfold? Wouldn't you be happy? What you learn from that story is, ostensibly, that I can make as many mistakes as I want in my life. I can be so far off track. I can disappoint God so many times. And yet, it is never too late for somebody to return. God will always allow me the opportunity to repent, to have some sort of feeling of regret, of remorse. So why would you cry? Ask them as Rishon Magid, I would be misameach, I would be so happy. I would celebrate the fact that it's never too late. So why is he upset? What's bothering him? Explains them as Rishon Magid so beautifully. Life is not about getting ourselves through the crack and figuring out how we're going to get into Olam Haba. That is not what life is about. Did Elazar ben Derdiah, the last moment before it was too late, did he make his way in? Of course he did. But you know why I cry, said Rebbe? Because this man's entire life was just wasted. Because there was not one meaningful day of his life that he lived. And that's a reason to cry. Life is not about whether or not in the end we will make it into the world to come. Life is about taking every experience that God blesses us to have and making that as meaningful as we possibly can. Making the right choices, making the right decisions. Adam nidan b'chol yom. God gives us that opportunity every day to make that decision, to make that choice. And that really is the reason why Rebbe cried, because it is so pathetic when you review the life that this man just lived. When you see how much it was wasted. When you see the incredible opportunity that he had, that all went down to be nothing. So one of the greatest leaders of our generation passed away a couple of years ago. Was a holy man by the name of Rabbi Yashiv. He lived in Yerushalayim. For those who may not have had the opportunity to ever have met him, he was an inspiring personality. Actually name one of my children after him. I was so inspired the few times that I had the opportunity to interact with him. He was an amazing, amazing person. The problem is, when I bought the Art Scroll book, I can't say I was disappointed, but I was a little bit bored. For the reason that basically every page tells the same story. He woke up very early in the morning. Every day he had a very rigid schedule. And he learned, and he learned, and he learned some more. And then he learned some more. And then you turn the page, and he did the same thing the next day. And it wasn't until I got to an unbelievable story in that biography. Just astounding. They write in his biography that he had, when he was over 100 years old, it was born in his family a seventh generation grandson. I don't even know what we call that in English. But we should all have that opportunity. What a blessing. Seventh generation grandson was born when he was still well enough to appreciate what that meant. Now I would hope, when I live to be over 100 years old, and I maybe will have the opportunity to see a seventh generation grandson, I hope that they'll be decent enough to make his bris in my community and not make me travel to them. But they didn't. And they write in the book that they plan to have the bris in Bnei Brak. which is a 45-minute ride from Yerushalayim. He was 101 years old. So they asked him if he would be willing to serve as the Sandik. And Rabbi Yashiv said, I have a very busy schedule. I'm not able to make it. His grandson admittedly said that he was a little bit disrespectful to his grandfather, and he decided he's going to try and push the issue a little more. So he went to Rabbi Yashiv and he said, Zaidi, don't you know that the Kabbalists write, somebody who has the opportunity to serve as a Sandik for a seventh generation that is born to them and their family goes straight into Olam Haba, goes straight into the world to come. Now, how many more opportunities do you think you're going to have? So how would you turn this down? And Rabbi Yashiv responded, they write, he didn't hesitate at all. He said, my plan is to walk through the gates of Olam Haba through the front door. I don't need the back entrances. I was amazed by that story. It's exactly what Rebbe's crying about. So we have people who get together and will daven 40 days at the Kotel, or they'll go to Kevar Rachel and they'll go to this person's grave in that place, and they'll wear a kameya and they'll wear a red string and they'll bake challah together, and all of them are wonderful. They're all great. But said Rabbi Yashiv, life is not about slipping through the crack. Life is about walking through the gates of Olam Haba through the front door, because every moment of life was spent the way it should have been. Every decision was made the way a decision should have been made. Every experience of life that we were blessed to have was spent in the right way. Of what good is it that this is a practice, a custom that you've taken upon yourself, if it makes no difference? I see that as a placebo button. It makes us feel good. It's an easy thing to do. Doing something makes us feel better than doing nothing. But it doesn't actually change the experience of life. So in this time of year, we read one of the beautiful haftarahs we're going to read in the coming weeks is Shabbos Shuva, Kuchu Imachem Dvarim Vishuvu El Hashem. Loosely translated, it means you should take all of your things and you should return to God. So Rav Zevin writes in one of his svarim, he says, what does it mean? He says, each person has their dvarim. Everybody has their idiosyncrasies, their things that speak to them. Everybody has them in life. And they're all wonderful and they're all great and we should never laugh it off. But he says, the objective of all of that is, kichu imachem dvarim. You have to take all of those different dvarim, all of those things in our lives, and galvanize all of those items, vishuvu el Hashem. Those all have to stir us to have a feeling that it's time to return to God. If that doesn't happen, then of what value are all these dvarim? What have they done for us? Have they enhanced our experience at all? Have they made any difference in the lives that we live? And that, he explains, is what the Navi means when we're told, Kichu imachem dvarim vishuvu el Hashem. Life cannot just be placebo buttons there just to make us feel good. All of them are wonderful as long as they make us feel a sense of responsibility, a sense of understanding that something more needs to come out of the experience that we have. So the Dubna Magid writes in another place a beautiful story. He says there was a very simple man who lived in a small village and he never really understood what life was like in the big city. He decides, you know, I'm getting in my 50s already. It's time for me to go learn. What happens in the real world? What happens in the big city? I'd like to learn. So he takes out a hotel room in the big city and he decides he's going to stay there all day and all night, look out the window, watch, observe everything that happens. All the businessmen running and going and into this building and out of that building, and everyone's doing their jobs. And he's very excited and he's watching very carefully, taking notes on everything he observes. And one fine evening, 3 o'clock in the morning, he sees there's a man who comes out into the Times Square. In the middle of the town square at 3 o'clock in the morning, he has a big metal pot with a spoon, and he starts banging ferociously on this pot. He's waking everybody up, and he sees everybody hears this, and they come running outside. So he decides, maybe I'll also go run outside. Is something happening? So he goes over to this individual. He says, what are you doing? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Is there something special going on? He says, look, down the block over there, there's a terrible fire. So I'm getting everyone's attention that we should put out the fire. And he watches in amazement how 5 to 10 minutes later the fire's out. It's unbelievable. So he stays there for another couple of days, goes back home. About 6 months pass. And after 6 months, lo and behold, in the small village, a fire breaks out. And everyone's screaming, everyone's concerned, everyone's nervous. And he turns to everyone and says, "Take it easy. I was in the big city. I know exactly how to deal with this. I'll tell you what to do. It's very simple." Runs into his house, takes a big pot and a spoon, and he starts banging ferociously on the pot. He says, "Everybody take it easy. The fire's going to go out, I'm telling you." Everybody's looking at him like he's crazy. "How do you think you put fires out by banging on a pot in the middle of the street?" He says, "I'm telling you, you think like small villagers. I was in the big city. I watched how they put out fires. This is what they do. I'm telling you, it worked within 5 to 10 minutes. Maybe here will take us longer." He's standing there for an hour. Meanwhile, half the city is burnt down already. And he can't understand. And finally, someone stops him. He says, "Listen, I also once visited the big city and I noticed that there was a fire. And let me tell you, you're missing everything that they did." Obviously, the man stood in the middle of the town square to get everyone's attention. He took a pot out and he banged on the pot with a spoon and it worked. How did it work? That didn't put the fire out. That just got all the people to run outside with water. And once they all came together with buckets of water, they put the fire out. Banging on a pot alone doesn't put out fires. Said the Dubna Magid, we come to this time of year, and we have all kinds of instructions in our machzor, in our prayer book. It says, at this time you should bend down this much. And at this point in the davening, at this point in our prayer, we should bang our chest this way. And at that point in the davening, we should bend down all the way to the ground. And now we should sit down and stand up and open the ark and close it. And we have all kinds of different motions that we do. We're banging on the pot. Said the Dubna Magid, you can bang on the pot all you want and you think it's going to work. If that banging on the pot and the sitting and the standing and the opening the ark and the closing once again doesn't make a person feel that now as a result of all of that, I need to take the water and put the fire out, nothing will happen. So you're afraid of that raging fire of Rosh Hashanah, what's going to be? The answer is not to bang on your chest or to bow down on the floor or to stand up or to sit down or to be in shul and to turn the pages and do everything that everyone else is doing. That will not do it. That needs to make a person feel kechui machem dvarim. Take all of those different ideas, all of those different motions, all of the aspects of our life that we consider to be a part of the routine of this time of year, v'shuvu el Hashem. All of that needs to rouse a person to feel that with all of that, I'm now going to take the next step and make a sincere leap into this aspect of tshuva, into this better and deeper understanding of what it means to be in a relationship with God. So the Rambam, when he delineates the process of tshuva, when he talks about the process of return, the Rambam writes, an imagery that always troubled me. I never really understood it. The Rambam writes that a person should imagine the following scene. God looks down on our beautiful world every year and he sees that there are many different communities. And there are some that are noble, that are righteous and virtuous. And there are other communities that are so immoral and are not deserving. They're subpar. And God has a major dilemma. He doesn't know what to do. The Rambam writes that God is conflicted. Should I continue to sustain this crazy world? Should I decide that maybe the world has come to the time when it should end? And God is unsure. And then after doing a very detailed calculation, the Rambam writes, it turns out, surprisingly, that the world seems to be very equal in the balance. And the Rambam says each human being needs to visualize as if they are the one who's going to tip the scale in either direction. You will be the one to make the difference. And I always found this Rambam troubling. Does he really mean, with a seriousness, that that's what I should feel? That can't really be what happens. That the world is perfectly balanced and I'm going to make the difference? So I've thought a lot about this Rambam, and I never understood what exactly he wants us to think about. And it wasn't until I noticed I'm not sure what it is about me, but often when I go through an airport, I think I'm a pretty innocent-looking person. Maybe I have the same name as somebody else. They think it's Natel. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But there's something I always don't just get, the regular take your shoes off and your belt. It's always more than that. More profiling. The pat down, the taking some another layer off. I don't know what I do. But I often think about it. Why is it that millions of people who travel every day all over the world, why is it that we all have to take our shoes off and be so inconvenienced every time we travel? Who remembers the days when we just used to be able to show up at an airport and get on the plane without all this hassle? You didn't have to come 2 to 3 hours in advance before a flight, international. Nobody was so concerned. And why all of this profiling? Why must I take my shoes off when I go to an airport? You know why? Because one crazy person in one airport at one time in the last 10 years figured out how to hide a liquid bomb in his shoe. And because of that, we all suffer the negative consequence because of one individual. Billions of people have suffered a consequence because of one person's idea, one person's evil action. You doubt the power of one individual? Look how one individual has changed our lives forever. So the Gemara tells us about the Ir HaNidachas. We just read it in Chumash a few weeks ago. You have a city that's a traditional Jewish community. Nothing unusual about it. And somehow this entire community has taken a leap of faith in the wrong direction. And the whole community begins to serve Avodah Zarah. They've given up on the Jewish religion. And the Torah says we have an unequivocal response. We have to burn the city, hacharem tacharimim. There could be no trace of its existence. So much so that there's even a discussion, what do we do about the Sifrei Torah and the mezuzahs that are in that city? Do we burn them as well? It's a serious discussion. Everything must be destroyed from that city. So how does this happen? How did this terrible tragedy start? The Torah says, if you look in the introductory comment to that story, it starts off by saying, Yatsu Anashim B'nei Belial. The Gemara comments in Sanhedrin, Miut Anashim Shnayim, which means, two nefarious men, two evil people, came to this town and convinced one family after the other to give it all up and to take a leap of faith and to now be dedicated and devoted to a new religion. Two people destroyed an entire city. Do you doubt the power of one individual? Look what two people have done. The Haftorah that we read on Rosh Hashanah is about the story of Chana, who wasn't able to have children. And it's obvious that one of the reasons why we read it is because she cried and she prayed, and ultimately her prayers were answered. It's a very powerful story. But I think there's an aspect of the story that perhaps is overlooked, and maybe it's relevant to Rosh Hashanah as well. Chana also had a husband. His name was Elkanah. Elkanah, we're told, was the Gadol Hadar. He was the most prominent member of his generation. And he lived at a time, the Medrash says, where people had no interest in frequenting the house of God 3 times a year. We have a mitzvah, we have a commandment in the Torah that we're supposed to visit the home of God 3 times a year on each one of the festivals, and yet nobody was interested. Elkanah was the only person doing it alone. So the Gemara says he used to travel from his house all the way to the house of God. And along the way, he refused to take out a hotel. He used to ba velan berechova shel ir. He used to sleep right in the middle of the town square. In the morning, when the members of the community woke up, they see, is that, it was a double take. Is that Elkanah? Is that really him? Can it be him? The most prominent member of our generation is sleeping in the town square. What are you doing here? V'hayisholim also, and they would ask him, why are you here? And he said, I'm on my way, the Beis Hashem B'Shilo. I'm going to visit the house of God as God expects all of us to do. And they would ask him, do you mind if we join you? And the Medrash writes, the first year he had 2 families, and the next year he had 5, and the next year it grew and it continued to grow. Ad Shahayu Kulam Olim. He transformed an entire generation. The entire generation began visiting once again the house of God. Do you doubt the power of one individual? And perhaps this is an additional reason why we read the story of Chana and Elkanah on Rosh Hashanah. Because the Rambam says in order to have a meaningful experience of tshuva, the first step is somebody needs to realize, every individual needs to appreciate how much of a difference they can really make in the world, how significant their existence really is. God has something that He wants me to do. God has a job. He has given me opportunity. He gives me so much experience that I can live out the way I want to. Adam nida mechol yom. God did not determine how I'm going to spend my day. I make that determination. That is reevaluated every day by an individual, by a human being. It's a chance that we're given. It's an opportunity that we all have. That so often goes unnoticed because we neglect to appreciate the power of the individual. How much one person can accomplish, how much one person can do. So let's close. The very first encounter that God has with Moshe Rabbeinu, the very first words that God says to Moshe Rabbeinu are Shalna alecha me'araglecha, famous words, take your shoes off, ki hamakom asher ato omed alea admas kodeshi, because the land, the ground in which you stand is holy and sacred ground. And therefore you must take off your shoes. Now I would imagine you have a nation that's living through oppression, terrible oppression. And finally God appears after hundreds of years of him almost being in abstention. God is hidden. Nobody knows what happened to him. And finally God appears to the leader of that generation. You would think the first words he would talk about would be something uplifting, something meaningful, something powerful. Go back and tell your people this message, but no. The first thing God tells him is, please take your shoes off. It's a little bit strange. And Rav Meir Shapiro, the great giant who instituted the Daf Yomi, who made a difference to every Jewish community all over the world in the last 100 years, Rav Meir Shapiro commented that on this occasion Moshe Rabbeinu was being taught the most profound lesson that he was instructed to teach every Jew from that day on. And so often, he says, so often you see people who are running to be in another place. If only my life was this way, and if only my circumstances were that, and if only God created me and bore me into this family, and if only my siblings were like this and my upbringing was like that, and if only my economic status was different and I lived in a different community, and everybody has all kinds of calculations. If only. And God teaches Moshe Rabbeinu the first time he meets him, Shalna alecha me'al raglecha, stop running. Begin to appreciate, ki hamakom asher ata omed alecha, the ground that you walk on, the situation and the circumstance that I have put you in, that is admas kodesh, that is the most holy and sacred ground you will ever walk on. And all you need to do is learn to appreciate its value. All you need to do is learn how much meaning you can infuse into that life, into that situation, into that circumstance that God has given you, that God has blessed you with. That is the most critical lesson, he says, Moshe Rabbeinu needed to be taught before anything else. Go and tell every Jew that you will meet from here on in, Shalna alecha me'al raglecha, just appreciate the life that God gave you. Understand that it's a blessing. Look how many people, unfortunately, do not have this tremendous gift of life. And look how blessed we are that we do have the opportunity to experience life. And now the question is, how will we spend that moment of life? Will we make meaning out of those precious moments of life? Will we make them something that is a sensational experience of really understanding God? Do we spend our time every day just going through everything that a Jew is supposed to do? Every week, every holiday, every season? Are they all just placebo buttons for all of us? Or do we make sure to remember, like we'll say in the Haftorah, Kechui machem dvarim v'shuvu el Hashem, take all of those different activities that you're involved in throughout the year, throughout the season, and throughout every experience of your life, and make sure that all of them galvanize you to be a person who is v'shuvu el Hashem, who is reminded throughout the daily experience of what it means to be connected with God. As we read this past week, Parshas Kisavo, the Gemara tells us the reason why we read all of these terrible curses in the last Parsha before Rosh Hashanah is because we wish each other. Techel Shana v'kilaloseha, Tachel Shana u'birchoseha. We wish to one another that all the curses that have befallen humanity in the past year should be a part of our history. And we hope, Techel Shana u'birchoseha, we hope that the coming year will be one that we will be able to usher in only blessing, only wonderful things, good memories, good experiences, positive times, and wonderful moments that God will bless each and every one of us with. That is the reason why we read this parsha. That is the humble blessing that we all give each other. I thank you all once again for coming, and I wish all of you from the depths of my heart, aksiva v'chasima tova, we should all have a wonderful year. We should come together for wonderful things, to share in simchas, to share in wonderful occasions and opportunities of being with one another. And you should all have so much nachas. You should all have so many good experiences with your children, with your families, and with your community. It should be a source of great pride to all of you, and it should be a source of nechama to your family as you commemorate the yahrzeit of Perel Etka Bas Reb Yitzchak Aleha Hashalom. Her neshama should have an aliyah. I wish all of you aksiva v'chasima tova.
Thank you, Rabbi Schechter.